In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about a subject that we have certainly touched on before. We have over the years tried to do a number of programs about energy, about our need for energy and how it will be met. And one of the things that we have talked about on previous programs is nuclear power. And we have talked with people who were proponents and people who were opponents to try to give you a chance to hear from people who will argue this issue both ways. In this part of the show, we'll be talking with someone who is an unabashed proponent of nuclear power, although someone who has not always been. Her name is Gwyneth Cravens. She has published 5 novels. Her fiction and nonfiction has appeared in a number of places, including The New Yorker, where she worked as fiction editor, and in Harper's. She's contributed articles and op-eds on science and other topics to Harper's, to The New York Times, to The Washington Post. And she is the author of a book that was published last fall that we'll be talking about. The title of her book is Power to Save the World, the subtitle The Truth About Nuclear Energy. It's published by Knopf, in which she explains that if you go back to, say, the 1980s, she certainly would have counted herself as an opponent of nuclear power. She even joined a successful campaign to prevent the opening of a new plant near her home. However, concerns about things like the need for energy and global warming led her to reconsider the pros and cons of nuclear power and spend a number of years doing research, and as a result, she changed her mind. And you can read all about that in the book. Questions, comments are welcome. I'm sure there will be people who will want to take issue with the guest, and that's certainly fine. We'd like to involve as many people in the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll free, it's 800-222-9455. Ms. Cravens, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I'm interested in how it is that you managed to change your mind about nuclear power, and I hope I'm representing your situation here correctly, from someone who not that long ago would have said that you didn't favor it, to now someone who believes that I think in order to it's a matter of, on the one hand, meeting our energy needs, on the other hand, concerns about other forms of generation and their effect on the environment, that you would say it's something that we're going to have to do.
It's something we have to do. And by the way, I was dragged kicking and screaming. I mean, the book took a long time to write because I kept coming up with arguments against nuclear power and talking to scientists who would shoot them down. And finally, since I believe in the scientific method, and not, by the way, not everyone does, but I do, and so that science won the day for me, actually getting the facts instead of speculation or outdated information changed my mind. And there were some key things that changed my mind. Number one is understanding something about baseload energy, electricity supply and demand. Baseload is that steady, reliable, around-the-clock electricity that, you know, if you get up at 4 in the morning and you turn on the light, it comes on 99% of the time or more. That is baseload. It runs our factories and hospitals and transport, you know, if you have electric transportation, streetcars or subway system in New York, you're using baseload. There are 3 ways to get baseload. One is by burning fossil fuels. They can supply steady around-the-clock electricity. By heating up water to make steam to turn turbines. You have hydroelectric power from dams. However, we only get about 5% of our electricity in the United States from hydroelectric power. Then the third thing is nuclear power. We get 20% of our electricity from nuclear power, and that supplies baseload energy. And it actually is the most reliable of all the baseload energy sources. I am told by people who have done comparison studies about the 3 kinds of energy generation that provide baseload. Until you put nuclear power in context, it's easy to be against it. You know, let's just go to something better. You know, we have a lot of choices in the United States. If you go to the store, there are like 25 different kinds of shampoos or pet food choices. So you think, well, you know, I kept saying to Rip Anderson, the scientist who was my guide through the nuclear world, let's just have solar and wind and conservation. And he said, all of those are good and they're important and we need them. But they, for one thing, they only supply a tiny, less than 1%. Wind and solar supply less than 1% to our grid. And they are intermittent and weak. And even if you have a huge wind farm, you still have to have backup because its output is erratic, whereas baseload energy is a steady, smooth outflow of electrons. So that, visiting the plants, nuclear plants and nuclear reactor laboratories and so on, seeing how reactors were pioneered and tested and pushed to their limits and beyond their limits, understanding what really happened at Three Mile Island and really happened at Chernobyl, all of these things contributed to my change of mind.
Hmm. So you would argue, and I think that there are other people who would make that same argument, that given our need for energy, that and if we're concerned about the possibility, the problem of global warming that's as a
right.
result of burning fossil fuels, that to meet our energy needs, we can do renewables and we should, but that there's simply no way to reduce fossil fuel use and meet current energy need without doing something else. And and what you're saying is that what that something else, your argument is what that something else would have to be is nuclear generation.
Yes. People talk about clean coal and good, let's do what we can. But the best way to cut carbon emissions is not have them in the first place. And nuclear power from its comprehensive life cycle, its carbon emissions are about the same as the comprehensive life cycle of wind power. You know, you need to burn coal to make the concrete bases, for example, for wind turbines and so on. So that's all factored in, and nuclear power is very... and when the plant is making electricity, it's not emitting anything. It's all the radioactive decay in the core of the reactor, which is, by the way, about the size of a kitchen, 12 feet by 12 feet. That radioactive decay is heating up. Energy is released. It heats up water. That makes steam. Under pressure, it's used to spin turbines.
Mm. There are, I'm sure that people who have concerns about nuclear generation, there are a number of things, and we can try and touch on some of them. Let me just ask you about one to start out with, and that is the fact that using nuclear generation, one of the results of the process is a highly radioactive waste that stays radioactive for a long time. Now, certainly burning coal produces a toxic waste. That is an issue as well.
It's radioactive, too.
But
highly.
It's not quite to the extent that we have with high-level radioactive waste that has to be safely stored for a very long time. And indeed, we here in the United States have been involved in an effort that has lasted many, many years. It's been quite expensive and lasted many years,
yes,
to build a site to store high-level radioactive waste. And you correct me if I'm wrong, but it's still not in Yucca Mountain out in Nevada?
Yes.
That was selected as a federal depository for high-level radioactive waste that was supposed to be operating a long, long time ago,
yeah,
and still not. That seems to be one of the most difficult sort of issues. It's difficult to handle. It's difficult to transport. and has to be safely stored for a long time. And I think for that reason, many people would say, and we've got enough of this stuff now. If we build more nuclear plants, we're just only going to end up with a lot more of it. And it's a very serious problem.
Well, it's not, technically, it's not a serious problem. It's certainly politically a serious problem because of all kinds of pieces of misinformation floating around. Now, what you've just said is all correct. And when the spent fuel is taken out of the reactor after about 18 months, and it is highly radioactive, they carefully transfer it to a cooling pool, and very quickly the most radioactive things decay. The hotter the radioactivity, so to speak, the quicker it decays. And so in about 20 or 30 years, it's much more easy to handle and ship and so on. So that's one thing. The other thing is, these days, the nuclear plants are transferring, after the spent fuel is cooled in the pools, they're transferring it to what they call dry cask storage. These are thick concrete cylinders that are on a concrete pad, quite fortified, thick concrete, and the fuel can just remain in there, I'm told, up to 100 years with no problem. And it's safe from, no one's going to get in there, and you can't really fly a plane into these small cylinders and so on. So that's... So that's called interim storage, and that really looks like the way things are going to go for quite a while. Yucca Mountain is, after a lot of meandering, having to do not with technical problems, but with the whole way that story was executed. By the way, I just suggest people are really interested in learning about Yucca Mountain, the National Nuclear Waste, high-level waste storage place. They can read the chapter in my book because there's a lot of twists and turns, but it has to do with management and so on, not with the actual fact, the question of whether waste can be safely stored. What people don't know is that nuclear waste has been safely stored since 1999 in a salt bed in southeastern New Mexico, half a mile underground. It's below the water table. It's extremely dry. It's very inaccessible, and when that repository is finished, when it's filled up finally, the shafts will be backfilled and sealed, and no one's going to go there. So there are things that can be done, and that happens to be defense waste. They've decided to have a separate repository for defense waste and civilian waste. So the Yucca Mountain is for the spent nuclear fuel. But I'm told that there's no reason why spent nuclear fuel could not be stored in southeastern New Mexico, and the people down there want it. That is, I don't know, they don't want it in their backyard. They want it in something like the waste isolation pilot plant that's working in New Mexico. But there's a really important thing that helped me understand the nuclear waste situation. Uranium is an extremely dense energy source. It's about the densest energy source we have. And so it, a pellet of nuclear fuel the size of my pinky fingertip, and I have narrow fingers, or thin fingers, it provides the same amount of energy as about half a ton of coal. So the actual waste from all the generation of trillions of kilowatt hours over the past 50 years or so from commercial nuclear power, all of that spent fuel could fit in, let's say, a single Target store. It's not a vast amount. By contrast, we get 51% of our energy from electricity from coal now. Coal waste is not isolated. By the way, nuclear waste is always isolated and shielded, and it's not in the biosphere. It's removed, it's kept out of it its entire life cycle. Coal waste is actually stored in the environment. It's slurry ponds. It gets into the toxic heavy metals from it, get into the water table. You just ask people living in Appalachia, where they not only blow up mountains to get the coal, but the slurry ponds, the slurry dams break periodically and poison the creeks and streams and water table. Coal, if you're worried about low-dose radiation, burning coal actually exposes people living within 50 miles downwind to 100 to 400 times more radiation than they would receive from living next door to a nuclear plant. So we have to put this in perspective. So the amount of spent fuel per year is about 2,000 tons. That's from 104 commercial reactors around the country. 2,000 tons. But because uranium is dense, it could fit in a very, in fact, in a small, very small, in a room. all the spent fuel in the world for 1 year from 440-some reactors could fit into a rather large townhouse in a city. You can just picture a townhouse, all of the spent fuel for a year. Coal's waste is staggering. In 1 year, Americans generate 100 million tons of coal, solid coal waste. That doesn't count the noxious gases that produce fine particulates that kill prematurely 24,000 Americans every year. Zero people have died from nuclear waste in the United States, commercial nuclear waste. But every year, 24,000 Americans die of heart and lung diseases from coal waste. It's just put in the environment as gases. But back to that solid waste from coal. That would fit in a coal train 9,600 miles long. That's just the annual waste. And that works out per person to, I think it's around 800 pounds per American. So we're paying a very high price to enjoy coal combustion, providing half of our electricity. Probably, if you want to average it out, probably the electricity that's powering the radio people are listening to right now, mm-hmm. and the electricity that's powering this phone call, 50% we're burning coal while we're talking. So if you compare the waste, there's just simply no comparison.
I'd like to, again, introduce the guest and bring some folks into the conversation, because I'm sure there are people who will have questions. We're talking this morning with Gwyneth Cravens. She is a novelist. She's published 5 novels. She has also contributed articles and op-eds on science and other topics to a variety of publications, including Harper's, New York Times, The Washington Post. And she is the author of a book that was published last fall that was a result of a number of years of research looking at nuclear power and how it is generated, its environmental impact, our need for energy. And it was her conclusion, and as I explained at the beginning of the program, she certainly didn't start out being in favor of nuclear power, much to the contrary, but she ended up changing her mind, and this is the book that has resulted. The book is titled Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy, and it's published by Knopf. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have callers here. I'll start out with someone here in Champaign County, where we are, line 1. Hello.
Hi. I agree with you on coal, and I think we need to phase out and go to a less energy-dense solution to the way we're living on the Earth. I don't think that includes nuclear power. The mining of uranium has killed a lot of people in the Southwest. There aren't many people there,
no.
But percentage-wise, yes, it has.
No, actually, that's not true. I looked into that because I had always assumed that was the case. I grew up in New Mexico. My neighbors were uranium miners. They would go up to Grants, to the mineral belt there and mine uranium. In fact, when uranium was being mined in the during the, there were a couple of booms, and it started being mined in the 50s, and there was another boom later on in the 70s. And during the first boom, it was not understood that radon was causing lung cancer in miners, especially the miners who smoked. You can't smoke in a coal mine because it'll blow up, but you can smoke in a uranium mine. And even though they put no smoking signs up, everybody smoked back then.
Well, I'm sorry.
You've
got to sort it out a little bit.
Let me come to my conclusion, please. They have done extensive medical studies about uranium miners. They've been followed for decades. And once they started ventilating the uranium mines, the radon exposure was radically reduced, and the lung cancer rate became about the same as the normal population rate. So some miners died, but not anything like what the number that die every year in coal mining accidents and from black lung.
Yeah, well, I wanted to go on and ask you about the economics. The Price-Anderson Act has been in effect for all this time. I gather you'll probably say that it's the fear of the population that has caused the economics of nuclear power to not cause them to take on the risk. This is what limits the liability for the nuclear industry. Between that and then this last energy bill, which basically ripped out any of the support for wind power completely, almost. It's been devastating. There's a lot of windmills going up around the region, and we're not going to see them joined by others because of this. And with this extra money that DeConcini, the disgraced senator from New Mexico, got in without any oversight, any kind of comment on it. This is what's kept the nuclear industry going, and it's because of the centralized nature of it. We need a decentralized energy solution. We don't need this massive baseload that you're saying.
What is your plan?
We don't need the massive baseload because it enables us to keep using energy in the wasteful way that we do.
So, if you are going in to have surgery in a hospital, are you okay with intermittent wind power powering the hospital?
That's a false
Well, no, point. I'd really like to know.
No, because, of course I. There are certain.
So you would be okay with a diesel generator keeping the hospital going if the wind power when the wind wasn't blowing?
There are a myriad of other solutions. There really are.
What are they? I'd like to know. I'm interested.
There are other solutions. There really are nuclear power.
What are they? If they're not,
we save more just overall. We have to do that to start with.
Well, I agree with you. I think this is a wasteful country, but even serious conservation, and I am all for insulating houses better and using low, light bulbs that don't suck up so much electricity and all of that. It's dreadful how much we waste, far more than in Europe, for example. So, yes, you gain something from conservation. Meanwhile, the demand for electricity is going up, and by 2030, it's expected to go up 40%.
In Freiburg, the suburbs that are solar-powered in northern Germany, and not northern Germany, but they export energy. They actually have more, they generate more electricity than they consume.
Well, that's great, but it's not baseload. And to provide baseload, Germany is building more coal-fired plants, which burn lignite and brown coal, the dirtiest coal you can burn.
Well, they're trying to sequester it underground too, but
I don't
like that as a solution. But
there is no coal sequestration, no sequestration of carbon going on at all anywhere.
They're planning to integrate that in, and they're talking to an area where we just got this huge sequestration project, which is questionable whether it'll really happen. It's true, and I don't actually see that as a major solution myself. But there are other baseload solutions, and there's the basic.
I want to know what else. Sunshine is not a baseload provider. So
well, you have ways of storage. You have individual storage.
How?
You have fuel cells in your home. You do
well,
have
Well, how do you make the hydrogen for the fuel cells?
Solar energy, which is a way of collecting
and
stabilizing the energy use over a period of time. It's
how
very
do you
easy
make the
that.
Trillions of tons of hydrogen you need to go to a hydrogen economy without burning fossil fuels or using nuclear power?
You can. It's very plausible. Hydrogen is just a way of storing the energy, and that's the base
load. Exactly, but you have to... hydrogen takes more energy to make... it's a storage. It's a container for energy, which is a good
thing. It doesn't take more energy to make if you're making it with solar and wind.
No, it takes. You have to put more energy into the process of electrolysis.
But if it's shining down from the heavens, you don't. You're not. It's energy that you can sequester in that fashion, and you don't need to.
You. It's at this point the technology. You cannot run New York City on fuel cells. You cannot run Chicago on batteries. I'm thrilled with the breakthroughs in battery technology that are going on. There's some very promising things coming out of, there's something coming out of Stanford, for example, that is very promising. But these are in the future, and let's go toward them. Absolutely. Nuclear power could use a storage mechanism also. It would be great. One of the most, probably the cheapest and most efficient way to make large amounts of hydrogen quickly is by using nuclear power.
I'm going to have to jump in here. I have to apologize to the caller because we're already halfway through, and I've got some other callers, and I simply have to move on. But just very quickly, to stay with the issue of economics, I think that some people would say that maybe the problem with nuclear power is that because the plants are complicated, they're expensive to build, they're expensive to run, there are costs associated
with...
Well, just let me finish. They're expensive. They are, next to solar power, they are the most expensive per kilowatt hour form of generation we have. And that for that reason alone, they would question whether or not we should go heavily into nuclear power.
Nuclear plants are expensive to build, no question. But they are... relatively cheap to run.
Mm-hmm.
If you build a gas-fired plant, the reverse is true.
Okay.
Cheap to build, expensive to run. And I talked to different people about nuclear plants, nuclear plant operators and retired nuclear engineers and so on. They all refer to nuclear plants as cash cows because I visited a plant in South Carolina, Oconee, which paid for itself after 8 years. And in the Southeast, electricity bills are really low, and it's because a lot of their energy comes from nuclear power. They can, and uranium has been a cheap source of electricity. So it's the picture is not so straight out.
Mm-hmm.
But, if you have to factor in a lot of the different aspects of energy generation, nuclear power is expensive, but if you consider it another way, the way the industry does, it's competitive with coal. But that's a whole discussion there.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have some other callers here. I want to introduce again the guest, Gwyneth Cravens. She is a novelist. She's published 5 novels. She's also a journalist and has written articles and op-eds on science and other topics for Harper's, New York Times, The Washington Post. She is the author of a book that was published last fall in which she makes an argument for nuclear power. The book is titled Power to Save the World. It's published by Knopf. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, she certainly did not always feel good about nuclear power, but as a result of a lot of conversations with people in the industry and scientists, she changed her mind, and he here makes the argument, as she has on the program, that if we're going to both meet our need for energy and address the problem of impact on the climate of energy production, that we're going to have to go in that direction, that we're going to have to rely increasingly on nuclear generation. Not everyone certainly will agree. People are certainly welcome here to call in with questions and comments. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And next we'll talk with someone in Decatur, line 4. Hello.
Thank you. I understand that the complications of getting cheap fossil fuel or any fuel, because it often is more polluting than we realize. And I think you've made a great point with coal. Two questions. Recently, Futurgen is going down to Mattoon, Illinois, and they have a coal gasification where they're going to take the CO2. And I was wondering what the potential problems with that would be, and would that be limit the amount of environmental problems that could arise? That's my first question. The second question is, why, since we have 56 degrees under the ground, aren't we delving more into geothermal than this 56 degrees can be for heat and cooling? And this would cut, as a conservation effort, but it would cut so much energy in this country if we were in that particular mode, and over a long term, too, I think. But those are the two. And then the other, maybe a third question is, you know, the nuclear thing is great, but the potential for problems in the sense of perhaps misuse of spent fuel or terrorist type of activities on plants, even though they are pretty well reinforced. But don't you think that before we, and I think you have a strong argument, but before we put a lot of emphasis on nuclear energy, don't you think it would be wise to go through geothermal before we take this particular avenue? Thank you.
Okay. Well, go ahead. You can...
Okay. I'll take these one at a time. Coal gasification, I'm not an expert on, but it's still putting carbon into the atmosphere. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is urging every carbon-free or low-carbon intervention we can do. And if coal gasification is going to lower carbon emissions, great. Some people think a coal gasification plant is a dirty environmental eyesore. So, but I have not followed that closely, so I'm not an expert there. Geothermal is a very good... Actually, geothermal is a very efficient baseload energy supplier, and we just use it. It's just done a little bit in the United States. Nevada, for instance, has, you know, fairly good percentage of geothermal energy it uses. But it depends on where you live. Geothermal is not available to people living in Brooklyn, New York, for example. So it's definitely something that should be expanded, and I'm happy to see that Google.org, this foundation that has been created to foster new energy research, is going in a big way into geothermal research. So that's great. In terms of the problems, like the misuse of spent fuel, it's very heavily guarded in this country, and it has been safely transported for many decades. And, you know, when fuel is brought to a plant, it comes from somewhere, right? And then it's transferred to the spent fuel pools, which are located mostly below ground, the fuel in the reactor. The reactor is sited underground. I've visited a plant where the reactor was 30 meters underground. So no normal person is ever going to encounter spent fuel, including a terrorist. It's just so much easier to blow up a chemical plant or something like that than to try to get past the guards and the gate through the checkpoints and the many, many, many barriers I can attest to from personal experience. You have to go through to get into a nuclear plant, and even then you don't get anywhere near the spent fuel or the reactor, and you just try finding it even. So I am, for one, not concerned about terrorism in America from spent nuclear fuel. You can get radioactive sources from hospitals. In fact, medical radiation now exposes Americans on average to more radiation, nuclear medicine, than the natural radiation we get from the environment. so, and the other thing about developing geothermal, yes, great, but the intergovernmental, the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is saying we have about a decade to really stop what's going on and do whatever we can. We have a technology that's mature, that has a proven safety record. Worldwide, nuclear power has the fewest deaths per terawatt year. It's compared to other large-scale energy sources. So I'm all for the small, you know, the windmills. I'm all for the solar panels. We need all of that. Pumped storage is another good way where you use nuclear power or wind power to pump water uphill and store it in a reservoir and then let it run down and turn turbines when you need it. There are a lot of different things we can be doing.
All right, let's talk with another caller. Let's go to Matt Toon. This is line number two. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
Is it correct that nuclear power in Europe, the plants are all standardized and they're more efficient than ours, and as our plants, they say, are different, have different plans that are not as efficient. And I was just curious, what do they do to their waste?
Well, there are a couple things. Let's talk about France, which gets 80% of its electricity from nuclear plants, which run their emissions-free high-speed trains. If you've ever traveled on one in France, it's quite an experience. Yes, the plants are standardized. The French just set out to do it all in one fell swoop. They designed the plants so that they all... I think that there are actually a couple of designs, to be precise, but let's just assume that, yes, their plants are standardized so that if a part fails in one plant, they go around and they replace that part in all the plants at the same time. In the United States... it's like in the early days of the automobile. Every car was sort of unique and kind of handmade, and that's sort of the way nuclear plants were built in the United States. So there are different styles of plant, and so when the nuclear workers come to a plant, let's say to exchange the fuel, to put in new fuel and take out the old fuel, they have to know that particular plant's design and so on. I don't know that French plants are necessarily more efficient. I actually have never thought about that. But it certainly is handier to have standardization. And that's what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is trying to do, to standardize the new designs that are being submitted. And there are a couple of plants that will be built in Texas that presumably will be meeting this new standardization. Okay, so in terms of waste, France recycles its nuclear waste. We don't. It's like putting a log. You go out in the woods, you cut a tree down, you have the log, you bring the log and you put it into your fireplace, you burn off the bark, then you immediately take the log out of the fireplace, take it out in the backyard and bury it. That's what we're doing with spent nuclear fuel. It retains about 95-98% of its energy and can be recycled. And when you recycle, when you reprocess fuel, you drastically reduce the ultimate volume of waste. It's very small. So the French does a very good job, and they plow some of the waste products back into the new fuel.
All right. Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. We just have about 10 minutes left. I want to continue to talk with people who are listening here and would like to be involved in the conversation. And we'll go over next to West Lafayette. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. I've been a visitor to the CERN laboratory in Europe, and there they're working on the thorium-based reactor.
Ah, yes.
Which is accelerator-based, which addresses, of course, the two main problems, as I see it, namely fissile material and waste.
Yes.
And that looks very promising. However, it's obviously not something you can do in the next few years. There may be a demonstration plant in Europe on this. I've heard rumors to that effect. but of course it's quite expensive. But it isn't an up-to-date, perfected technique. But conceptually, it is very, very attractive.
I agree with you. I actually talked with Ambassador Tom Graham, who was President Clinton's ambassador, regarding non-proliferation issues. And he's now the head of something called Thorium Power. And they have a website, thoriumpower.com. And it is very interesting. He said that they're really quite active in changing over uranium-powered reactors to thorium-powered ones. And it's true. They do not present the problems of proliferation from spent fuel. And thorium is very abundant. It's one of the most abundant elements around.
Yeah, you can get it from sand and so on.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you're interested in a more direct connection, there is a gentleman by the name of Jean-Pierre Revol, who has written a summary of the situation and what they've done so far. These are not hybrid. These are the thing that they're interested in directly is accelerator-based.
Right.
Which would make it safer, et cetera, et cetera. This is not to negate your very good arguments for uranium power. But I thought I'd call your attention to it. And if you wanted that connection in Europe, it might amuse you.
That would be great. My website is cravenspowertosavetheworld.com. If you would be kind enough to email me, care of my website.
That's C-R-A-V-E-N-S, Craven?
C-R-A-V-E-N-S.
Power to Save
powertosavetheworld.com. Craven's Power to Save the World is all one word.
Yeah. Okay.
And when you get to the website, it says contact, and you click on that, and you can send me an email.
I'd love
to know about it.
Yes. Well, the accelerator-based one is particularly attractive from the conceptual point of view. But, of course, it has to be demonstrated in terms of actually having a plant, costs, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
But
anyway,
I very much enjoyed your program.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for the call. We'll go next to another caller here in Urbana. This is line 3. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. A very interesting program. This is a subject I've been looking into a lot in the last couple of years, as I'm sure we all have. And I was a little disappointed to hear the conversation between the speaker and one of the previous callers. It was the discussion about the hospital on intermittent wind power. That struck me as a pretty ad hominem attack there. I mean, nobody thinks that wind power is the only solution possible in the space. And in fact, I'm a big fan of nuclear, but to try and dismiss wind power because the wind doesn't blow all the time is the same as trying to dismiss nuclear power because you have to change the rods every once in a while. It's a straw man. You yourself just a few moments ago discussed some of the methods of storing energy that are available now, and there's lots and lots of them. The question is how efficient they are. It's not a question of whether there are effective methods of storing energy. It's just which one you want to choose. So that was one point. Another, you raised a question about gasification because I guess you haven't looked into it too much, but I just wanted to answer the caller's question there. Gasification is a way of increasing the efficiency both of a coal plant and or of anything that produces CO2. It's a way of sort of reusing the CO2 to produce more energy. And even just recently there was an announcement about using solar power to gasify the CO2 that's produced at a coal plant and thus get some more life out of the coal, more or less. So you would then, for example, you could gasify the coal, you could turn it into, you could gasify the CO2 that's produced by burning the coal, you could then turn that into gasoline, you could burn that in cars, and while the cars would be emitting CO2, they wouldn't be emitting more CO2 than the coal had produced. So that was one thing. A third thing, a couple weeks or maybe months ago on this very program, you had a fascinating person talking about biofuel.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about the fact that biofuel seems to sequester a very large amount of the he said I think 13 times as much carbon is sequestered by certain plants in their root system as is then burnt when you cut them down and then burn them or whatever you do to create the ethanol. So I wonder if that's been addressed. Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
We got you. fine points. I don't know how, Ms. Cravens, how you would like to respond.
I had one more question, and then she can respond to all of them.
Sure.
I wanted to ask, you mentioned that the intergovernmental panel said that we have about 10 years to react to this problem. My impression is that it'll take a lot longer than that to get any new nuclear plants operational in the U.S. Is that accurate or inaccurate?
Well,
be interested to hear your reaction.
Okay, I'll start with that one. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has made a big effort to speed up the whole process. Before, it was this long, tedious thing where you got permission to use a certain site, and you got a license for the site, and then you got a license to build the thing and a license to operate it. There's no technical reason why a nuclear plant can't go up in 5 years, and I understand that in other countries they can do that. So it's not a technical problem; it's a bureaucratic problem to get them up and running more quickly. And I think the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is highly motivated to streamline that process. And also, new reactor designs are much more streamlined. I mean, all the reactors online are, the nuclear plants online are, you know, I think the last one to go online was in the 90s. So, but a lot of them have been uprated, that is, parts replaced, and so that there's hardly anything left of the original reactor or the original plant. They've been upgraded so often. So, you could, in theory, build a reactor more quickly, and there are other countries that can do that. But I agree that it may take longer just because of bureaucracy, and that's a problem. But getting, for example, the country reliant on wind and geothermal and solar would take much longer because a huge kind of infrastructure would have to be produced. I'm sorry you thought that what I said was an ad hominem attack about the wind in the hospital. I didn't mean that at all. I favor wind, and there are resources for storage, as I mentioned. It's just that this is a technology that's just starting out, and I think we need wind power, and it has its place. Jesse Oschebel, an environmentalist, a green who convened the first global climate change conference, I think in 1979. He's the head of the program for the human environment at Rockefeller University. Did calculations of the energy sources from renewables. He compared them with nuclear, and concluded that nuclear per square meter was the greenest possible source of electricity, that wind and solar, the environmental impact of them and of a hydroelectric to meet our country's needs would be gigantic. So what I was asking the gentleman who was talking of arguing that we didn't need baseload power was how he planned to keep the lights on steadily. And I was interested. I thought maybe he had some solution.
We're coming to the point here where we're going to have to finish, and we have some other callers that I don't think that we can take. My apologies. The only thing I can say is that over the years we have tried to do a number of shows on energy issues and different forms of energy and how we would meet our energy need, and certainly we're going to do that in the future. We'll continue doing that. This will not be the last show by any means that we'll do dealing with these issues. But having said that, what thought would you like to leave with folks?
Well, that nuclear is green, it's environmentally friendly. We, in countries that have a lot of nuclear power, like France, the per capita greenhouse gas figures are very low, and we don't really have a lot of time, so we need to think carefully about all of this and support whatever is going to work to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and the pollution issues, which are killing 24,000 Americans a year from fossil fuels.
Well, again, as I say, we will, I'm sure, be talking about these issues from different perspectives again in the future. For the moment, if you would like to read more of this book that our guest has done, Gwyneth Craven, she is a novelist. She's written published five novels and also done journalism and has contributed articles and op-eds on science and other topics to Harper's, New York Times, Washington Post. Her book, this was published last fall, is titled Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy, and it is published by Knopf, and I'm sure that you can find the book in the bookstore or by this time in the library. Ms. Cravens, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David.